Hi everyone, this is Simone Davis and welcome to the Montessori Notebook Podcast. I am super excited to get started on this podcast and to share with you everything that I've learned about the Montessori approach from working in Montessori for more than 15 years and raising two children in a Montessori way as well. And I also have invited friends, families, and educators who use Montessori in their work and their daily lives, and I hope that it will be really, really helpful to you to get an example of what other people are doing and how they use it and actually how simple it really is. So we're definitely going to demyth that Montessori needs to be complicated, that you need to buy a lot of things. It's actually very much less is more for me in how I apply the Montessori approach. Each episode, I'll also answer a listener question, and that will be at the end of the episode. So definitely wait till the end for that. Today's a little different. You'll actually hear me talking. I'll introduce you to Montessori and some of the things that I love about it. And then we will chat with my family. You'll get to meet my daughter, Emma. She's nearly 18. Oliver, he's 19 now. And their dad, Luke. And so, yeah, let's start at the beginning then. What is Montessori? So whenever I get asked this, I always say, well, we know what traditional education is, you know, where the teacher is standing in the front of the classroom and they decide what everyone needs to learn that day. So in kindergarten, for example, everyone's going to learn the letter A today. But this is actually, you know, based on the idea that everyone's ready to learn at the same time. It's a very top-down approach, and it's also very demotivating for children because if you're not interested in what the teacher's talking about, there's people who are disruptive. It really doesn't suit all learning types at all. And then in the Montessori approach, on the other hand, it's very much child-led. So what it looks like is a classroom with beautiful materials laid out in a beautiful sequence. It's a very comprehensive curriculum where each activity builds on the next one in different subject areas. Like in a 3 to 6 classroom, they start with mathematics and language, and there's cultural studies, practical life, many areas of the classroom, very rich curriculum, very much holistic education, and not just academic, but also social skills as well. And so you have this beautiful, rich classroom, and the teacher is more like a guide, and the children actually are self-motivated, amazingly enough, to choose for themselves what they'd like to work on, and they can work on activities where they're up to. There's also a mixed age group in the Montessori classroom, so you generally have a 3-year span, and so then the older children are modeling for the younger children, and they can also help the younger children. And the children who are younger just, you know, look up to the older children and learn so much from them. So it's a very organic way to learn. The children can remain curious because they're not, you know, getting the love of learning sucked out of them by having to learn for tests or sit still or put up their hand to use the toilet. They're allowed to freely move around the classroom. There's a lot of freedom, but there are a few limits, and the teacher sets those with kindness and clarity. So these principles can then also be applied just in how you live with your own child. So when I found out about Montessori, we started using the ideas at home, and it's helped me so much. So with my work running a Montessori playgroup here in Amsterdam, writing my book, The Montessori Toddler, and now this podcast, I really want to help you also take these principles into your homes and into your classrooms if you're a teacher. So let's, some of the things that I really love about Montessori, I thought that would be fun to share as well. It's definitely, to me, a way of keeping curiosity alive in children. That love of learning that I was talking about is, you know, stimulated by, rather than giving children answers to the questions, we really encourage them to find out for themselves. So you might want to do that at home or with your child. Like, instead of they say, oh, you know, why does it work like this? Instead of answering immediately, you could say, oh, I wonder why. And then you could actually try and discover together. And then over time, you can show children how they can look up information or to ask a neighbor or to go and visit a bakery if they're interested in why bread rises in that way when you add the yeast. Excuse my squeaky chair. This is a very raw podcast. You'll get all of the sounds of Amsterdam, probably traffic on the streets and things like that as well. It's part of this very relaxed conversation style that I love so much and hopefully will be really useful to you. What I also love is that it recognizes that we're following each child's development. So instead of everyone, having to learn everything on the same day, we all know that we all learn at different paces and we have different interests and we learn in different ways. And in a Montessori approach, you can do that. And so I love using this idea, you know, inside the classroom, outside the classroom, just recognizing that things, you can follow the child more. This means that they might be slowing down and walking at their pace to go to the shops and then allowing time for that. It can't happen every day, but they're much more curious about the world around them. I work with toddlers, which is around 16 months to 3-year-olds, and I also have a baby class as well. And these toddlers are so fascinated by the smallest things that come up in their way, and you realize just, we miss everything. They're spotting weeds growing up between the pavers, and we're making lists in our head. And so it's really lovely to be reminded by children how we can also be more present in the world. So they're curious, and also this hands-on learning. So in Montessori, they have these concrete materials. So rather than, you know, worksheets to fill out or copying something down, you actually, for example, some of the maths material is so beautiful, and I wish I had have learned this way. You basically have, for example, when you're learning numbers, something like the golden beads, and you have one tiny golden bead that makes one, and then a bar of 10 beads makes 10, and then 10 of these bars laying together makes a mat of 100, and then you have 10 mats on top of each other making a cube of these golden beads that's 1,000. And then it's very easy to visualize this is 1 and this is 1,000. And you can get very young children doing very complicated additions, because if you write down something like 1,333 plus 4,621, then you just go off and you go and get all of the thousands blocks and all the other thousands blocks. I can't remember the numbers I just said, but you work out it out, and then you can write down exactly how many thousands you have beside it. So it's a much more concrete way to learn, and then gradually you won't need those concrete materials and you move to straight to abstraction. But even children who might be between 9 and 12 year olds, if they need to, they can go back and use those materials as well. So I always think, like, when I'm working with children, or when I, you know, with my own children, how can we make the world a much more tactile place with hands-on learning? So it's really fun to get your hands dirty, to experiment and to make discoveries for yourself, than someone telling you the answers. So it's definitely keeping curiosity alive. Another thing I love about Montessori that really was such a big relief for me to find out was that I was the child's guide. So it wasn't just my role to make them happy, because, you know, that can make a child just feel quite entitled, actually, if they get whatever they want. But it was also my role to help them calm down when, you know, they had difficult feelings. It was my role to be their safe place, really, to help them process any, you know, emotions, feelings that were coming up. And also, sometimes the most difficult is to help them take responsibility when something's gone wrong. And being that guide means that I'm not taking it personally, but I'm there to support them. And I feel like that role, it was actually a much more relaxing place to come from than being their boss or their servant. You know, as their servant, you know, they're in charge and they're bossing me around. And if I'm the boss, then a lot of children either comply or they get around your back and they become actually very cheeky. So a bit of both. So I really love this idea of being the child's guide, and I'm sure that this is something that we'll get into as we get further into the podcast series. Another thing I love about Montessori is observing children. This is the idea that every child's unique, and we don't really know what they want to learn in this moment, because it's always a new moment and they're changing constantly. So observation means that we're like a little mini scientist, and we pretend that we've never sat in our child before, and like, look at all the movements they're making, look at their fine motor movements, look at the words that they're saying, the sounds that they're making, the nonverbal communication, the social development, them observing another child. You can take in so much by, you know, being a factual observer, and then from there you can take all this information and say, oh, I noticed they were really interested in this, and maybe next time I'll offer them this, and I'll change out maybe an activity in our shelves based on them, or what's not working right now. Also, I love using observation to change your environment. So even today, I was about to record this episode and we'd had trouble when I was recording with Emma. Our chairs kept squeaking and I've got these old chairs in my desk and I was about to sit down and think, I've got to sit very still. And then I just thought, why don't I change something? I'll just go and get a chair from the kitchen and sit on that instead. So you can constantly, you know, keep looking at your spaces, what's working, and your spaces will evolve as your children get older as well. You know, it's also fun to see that they're learning in different ways and it really makes you see them with fresh eyes as opposed to what you want to teach them, what your child wants to learn. So many things to talk about, but another thing I think I really felt I appreciated is that it's okay to set limits with your child. Actually, your prefrontal cortex, that's the front part of your brain, is still developing until your early 20s. So a toddler is definitely, their impulse control is in its infancy. But even a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old, you can think, you know, they should know better. But actually, that's that prefrontal cortex that's, you know, controlling that isn't always active. And so we have to be there to help them. And I love the phrase that my friend Jean-Marie Pennell says, and she says, it's my job to keep everyone safe. And so you can say that as you sweep up a toddler to keep them safe from running on a road. It's my job to keep you safe. We don't set so many limits because if you just say no all the time, then they, you know, become deaf to you, I think sometimes, or they don't respect it. They also feel like their curiosity is being stifled, but there's so many ways to set limits with love, and we'll definitely get into gentle parenting and positive discipline and ways to help our children listen. But I really felt like if I set my limit clearly, then I don't cross my limits and I don't get so frustrated. So Montessori is not about letting your child, you know, do whatever they like. That's like a laissez-faire approach, and it's not like being a dictatorship either, where the parent's in charge and there's no say in the matter. It's somewhere very much in the middle where you have a lot of freedom and we're observing the child, we're following their lead, but then the parent is also okay to say, oh, I can't let you hurt your sister, you know, that really hurts them. Or it's my job to keep everyone safe, you go here and you go here. So you can set a limit, you know, in a kind and clear way without getting angry, but just being clear that safety is important to you. And then I guess this all comes down to respect for the child and respect for ourselves. Respect that every child is very capable, that their opinions matter, that they're valued and that they're unique. And respect for ourselves because it's a lot of these child-led approaches. I think sometimes the children don't learn any limits, or they don't learn that there's other people who can, you know, be affected by our actions. Where I love that sometimes, you know, it's something that makes us feel uncomfortable. So you could say, oh, you know, I'm worried, or that's making me feel uncomfortable right now. Or it's important to me that, and you can actually say what's important to you. So you're actually modeling boundaries, and boundaries are really important because if we don't express them, then we can sometimes feel very frustrated. Or we end up getting very angry and we snap. So I love that it's just given me a framework for being a much more kind, clear, loving parent that also builds this respectful relationship with their child. Hello to the neighborhood dog. So I didn't actually go to a Montessori school myself. I went to a traditional school. I had quite a traditional upbringing. And so when it came to raising my own children, and I felt like I didn't want to bribe them or threaten them to get their cooperation, I didn't want to put them into time out, but I really didn't know of what else to do. So that set me on a mission, like, you know, reading books. And I learned a lot from going to a Montessori playgroup with my son. Thank you to Fern Fonsell for everything I learned there. And then we attended parent evenings once Oliver started preschool at the Montessori preschool. And I learned a lot from Anne Morrison. That was the teacher, his teacher. Really, really grateful to her. And then there were books, and there wasn't things like Facebook or Instagram or Montessori blog posts. And so we just muddled through. But I learned so much, and I really felt like it helped me so much as a parent and as a teacher as well. Once I started doing my Montessori training with Judy Orion, and really learning to see from the child's perspective. And I wanted to share that with more families. So now here in Amsterdam, for the last 11 years, I've been running my own Montessori playgroup. And it's lovely to work with the parents alongside the children because it's a Montessori classroom where everything's laid out at the child's height. There's, you know, artwork on the walls at their height, plants for them to care for. We make snack together, and then we set the table, clear the table, and parents start to see, oh, if my child can do this at playgroup, they can do that at home as well. They also might see how I address their child and think, oh yeah, I don't think I would have used such a respectful way to speak with the child. And I think that's what you notice when you go to a Montessori school or you meet a Montessori teacher and they speak in that way that's so respectful, not only like just the way they would speak to you. And it's really lovely to see. So I've kind of become very passionate about sharing everything that I've learned. You do really question as a parent, like, oh, what do I want for my child? What do I want them to get out of school? And then you might start to realize, oh, actually, I could use a lot of these ideas in my home. And then you begin to peel back the layers of the onion, because it's not just about the Montessori activities or setting up your home, but you realize it's actually about yourself as a person and being the best human you can be, because you realize, oh, actually, what I say is one thing, but what I do is much more powerful. And you realize you're a model for your children. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who's wanted to keep improving so that I can be the best parent I can be to my children and raise them in a way that they become responsible humans as well. So I think, you know, now that Oliver and Emma are 19 and nearly 18, I've learned really to be present and to enjoy every moment. I've really enjoyed every age. And so when people say, oh, wow, they're already at university, or oh, they're in their last year of high school, that must have gone quick. I think actually, I feel like I've enjoyed every age and every stage. And when you think you're going to miss them being a baby, and you do, but you're just so excited for all the new things that they're learning. So some things, the simple things really, of what I enjoyed the most were, you know, going to the parks, making little picnics to take with us, the children helping me a lot of the time to prepare the food, playing in, we had a backyard and the kids would be out there in their pajamas and their gumboots is what Australians called rain boots. You know, just keeping things really simple. Now that we're living in Amsterdam, it would be like walking in the city, riding our bikes. We don't have a car here at all, so it's really just like slowing down. We also have amazing museums here, and so the children from a very young age came to the Van Gogh Museum and all the other museums that we have on hand here. Eating meals together became really important to me. I think I eat breakfast every day with my children. I have second breakfast when they wake up late now as teenagers. We eat almost every night together unless they're out at a friend's place. But we don't have TV dinners. We just enjoy each other's company. And it's really the simple things. Baking is one of my favorite things. We've baked with the kids since they were really, really small, and, you know, mixing ingredients. First, you know, we'd measure them out and they'd add the ingredients, and over time they've become, you know, really independent and good in all these skills as well. So they get those life skills, which is also very helpful for raising these adjusted humans. And when I think of their childhood, I also think of a lot of sensorial experiences, like being barefoot in the grass or going for like walks in the middle of winter along the beach here. That's one of my favorite things to do, and how I like to try and start the new year if I can. And letting them walk was another big thing that we would do. So Oliver was like 1.5, and we'd go to the park, and you just realize that actually after you had an hour to go to play at the park, but if you let them walk, we'd probably get to the park and then have to come back already. And it was just one block from our house. Similarly, we'd go and pick up a newspaper from the newsagent, which was across the bridge. And that would be our afternoon outing. We just loved that the interactions that we had with the people who worked there. We can go back and they still recognize our children because we were always there, you know, interacting with them. And these are the things that you end up remembering. It's not about what you bought, and it's not about expensive things. It's about the small moments, just enjoying all of those things. Trips to the library, that was something that I've always enjoyed. And now that the children can get on their bikes and go up to the library by themselves, it's like not quite the same. I feel quite nostalgic for that, I think, definitely. we'd be able to borrow 10 books at a time. And so we'd come back and renew them 3 times and then go back. And I think the children, especially when we first moved to the Netherlands, they got through all of the English books in the library very fast. And then they were ready for the Dutch books as well. So that's been really nice. I think also just how we've lived our lives in a simple way. I've always really tried to encourage the children that we don't buy things that we don't need, that, you know, we, if they have a pair of shoes that work, then that's their trainers. And when those trainers, you know, wear out, then they'll get a new pair of trainers. And if Oliver needed a new pair of trainers, but Emma didn't need a new pair of trainers, then just Oliver got a new pair of trainers. So it was always just on need. And I think definitely these days with, you know, people just throw things out and we get so many shoes and, you know, we don't actually need that much. So I think that's something that Montessori is about as well, is living in a simple way that's very respectful to the environment as well. So one thing that's really important in all of this is looking after ourselves. There's no way that we can be kind, respectful, patient if we're burnt out ourselves. And so some of the things that I've realized that I need to do for myself is to, you know, take time each day. Like it would be when the kids have gone to bed, I'd have a bath and soak in the bath each night. I love reading before I go to bed, and that fills my bucket as well, even if it's just a couple of pages. Before I fall asleep, I listen to podcasts, I meditate, I'm an advocate for in-bed meditation, and that just means that I lie in bed, give myself permission, like once the alarm goes off, to lie back down, and I listen to my breath, and then I notice how my thoughts are probably quite busy. And I like to say that you can't be bad at meditation because you just notice how busy your thoughts are. And some days it actually can be quite quiet. And then you can always come back to that when the day starts getting a bit chaotic. You're like, oh, I'm going to find that peace that I had when I was lying in my bed doing my meditation. I've also found that Ayurveda principles can be really helpful for me as well. It really teaches you to balance your doshas. That's maybe something that I can talk about in other podcasts if you find that interesting. But I have quite a lot of vata and pitta, and so when I'm feeling quite ungrounded and too many ideas and things swirling in my head, then I can do a yoga practice that's more grounding. I can do abhyanga, which is like a sesame oil massage in the evening. I can eat more warm cooked meals, as opposed to, I love crackers and light airy food, but that's really bad for vata. Coffee is not great for someone with lots of vata. Anyway, I can share more about it if you find that kind of thing interesting, but it's, you know, what kind of things make you feel calm? For me, it's getting out into nature and slowing down. And maybe for you, it's actually very going and meeting up with friends and being very sporty. So you have to recognize that what works for me is not necessarily what will work for you. I think, that's probably a really long introduction to what I love about Montessori and what it gives you a little bit of insight into me. And now I'm going to hand over to Emma and I was interviewing her to have an insight into how she found it going to Montessori school and having a Montessori teacher as a parent. I hope you enjoy it. And hello, I've got Emma sitting next to me to record the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Hi.
So, where should we start? Let's start with, you being a kid. Do you remember much about your childhood or what you liked doing when you were smaller?
I really liked to play with Lego or Playmobil and just think of stories and draw lots and crafts and things like that.
Yeah. And nowadays, do you say it would be pretty much the same? No, you don't play with Lego
anymore. Not really. I do still really like drawing. I like baking and things like that. What do I like? I like reading.
Friends. You spend much more time with your friends these days,
yeah,
too. That's been sweet. Super sweet. So maybe we could say you went to Montessori school, you started at Fern's Playgroup. Then you went to Anne's class from until we moved.
Yeah.
And then you were at the Amsterdam's Montessori school until from 4 years old to 12 years old.
Yeah.
And so do you remember anything that you liked about Montessori school?
I think I liked having lots of independence and getting to choose what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Instead of just having to do the same thing that I didn't want to do.
Yeah. Do you remember any learning any particular topics or subjects or anything?
I remember things like the maths things at school where you had like all the things that help you learn counting and like multiplying and subtracting and all of that.
Yeah, would you even be able to explain one of them to us?
I remember I got to learn multiplication early.
Yeah.
And what they did had for that, they had this little wooden board that had all these like empty spots in it where you could put these tiny little like pins in.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you had 1 to 10 on one side and 1 to 10 on the other side. So then, say you were doing 1 times 1, then you would put it in like where the, like, yeah, where the 1 and the 1 are. So then you would just have one little pin in the board. And so if you would do 10 times 10, then you would have the whole board filled in and it would be 100 pins. So that was like...
You worked it out in a very concrete way.
Yeah, so you actually get to see like, so if you have like 10 tens, then that's...
Yeah, 100. I like how they do that rather than just writing it down on a piece of paper where it's really abstract. First you do it with numbers and then gradually by the time you're in the Bova Bell, which is like 9 to 12, you don't need that board anymore. Yeah. You can calculate yourself or you could always go back to the materials if you needed it. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's super interesting. I also remember that you had quite a bit of free time. Like, I guess you spent so much time in a traditional classroom by everyone having to go to the toilet at the same time, everyone having to sit still, be quiet while the teacher listens. And I think you were reading for a couple of hours a day.
Yeah, I think I did get told in group 5 that I wasn't allowed to read in class anymore because that was the only thing I was doing. Yeah, I do think that is a thing where I would just do what I wanted to do and that... So then I did sometimes, like, not do certain things, or if I would pick something up and I had trouble with it and I couldn't get the teacher's attention for a bit, then I would just lose interest and want to do something else.
So. Yeah. So you have to be a little bit self-motivated, don't you?
Yeah. So, which I guess is a good skill to develop. So.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like, do you think that it kept you creative as well in the way that you saw this? Like, did you have a lot of options to do creative projects and things like that as well?
Yeah. I think I, like, around group 7 and 8, I started drawing a comic with a friend. Mm-hmm. So that was quite fun. We got to be creative and...
And did you present it to the class as well?
Yeah, we did a presentation about it.
So writing a comic is still a valid work. And, you know, actually the social skills and, you know, working with a friend and developing a story, that's all like language.
Yeah, I guess.
Indirectly. Yeah, cool. Sounds pretty positive to me. And so after all this freedom in a Montessori school and you ended up going to, it's a Dalton high school, but it's still quite traditional.
Yeah, so you have like it's scheduled when your lessons are, but you do get a bit more, like, it's not the teacher's explaining for the whole lesson, and you get 1 hour a day where you go to whatever classroom you like, and you can work there, and you can ask the teacher questions and things like that. And I don't know, I didn't find the transition very hard, I think, but then I do sometimes, like, I think I still have the thing of sometimes, for example, if I would have a test coming up, then sometimes I will like sneakily do my maths homework in a different class or something.
One thing I think has been really nice is that I have never really had to help you with homework. You and Oliver both have been quite self-standard, so quite independent in planning and getting your work done. Yeah. And I think maybe that's from your Montessori days.
Could be.
Because, I mean, I definitely support you in saying, oh, you know, this weekend we have a couple of things on. Do you think you'll have time to get all you need to things done? I try and ask you what's coming up and what's going on, but I try not to... I leave it up to you as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a good balance?
Yeah, I think I've never really had a problem with the balance, and I think I could ask you for help if I...
Yeah.
...need help with anything.
I was rather enthusiastic about your Profilwerkstück, which is your end-of-year project.
Yeah.
Emma has an 80-hour project, which she's just finished, which was they get to choose any topic that they like, and you chose, like, a climate-friendly... diet or sustainable food choices and things, and I kept saying, oh, what about this and what about that, and it was the first time I really felt like I was interviewing in your work because I was so excited about the topic. But you enjoyed
that fun.
Research actually, which is a good thing to ask you because you are part of Generation Z. I don't know what I say now.
It's funny, I don't know, I think because
Gen Z, they say
it's quite an American idea, so there probably is the American pronunciation.
Yeah. What do you think about the future of the planet? I mean, we're really at a critical moment in time, and sometimes you can get quite depressed about it, and sometimes it can be like, no, there's hope for the future.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I don't feel very hopeful. Like, I think there's a lot of people with good ideas about it, but then it always feels like, you know, because we live in a democracy, and it feels like kind of still the majority doesn't really have those ideas, or like the people that can vote also. Like, you know, I'm 17, so I still can't vote. And I think especially when it comes to the future of the planet, it's like, I wish there was actually a way that we could incorporate like teenagers being able to vote, because it's kind of our future as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me feel a bit like, yeah, not that hopeful when it's like, actually now our future is being decided by a bunch of like 70-year-olds. That's kind of
and maybe, yeah, disconnected with what's really happening right now.
Yeah, or just, you know, obviously they also have their own things that they want from politicians and things like that.
Economics and,
yeah. Yeah, and just the whole fact that I think economics is definitely seen as a priority to sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And
how you can make both work.
Yeah, exactly.
It was cool to see you wanting to take part in the climate demonstrations. That was like a part of a way that you could, as teenagers, yeah, show yours, you know?
Yeah, I have no idea if it actually made any difference, but...
That's a good point, isn't it?
Well, if I stay home, I'm not making a difference either, so...
You felt like you were trying.
Yeah.
Yeah? So, this is your last year in high school, and next year you're thinking of having a year off and that kind of thing, but at the moment you're busy looking at studies and what you might choose to go on to. What are you thinking about?
Right now I'm quite interested in liberal arts and sciences, because that way I can kind of study a lot of different things at once, because I have very broad interests, and like at the start I was looking at lots of like maths or physics studies. And then I kind of had to think, like, I don't actually know what I can do with this, like, in the real world. And I don't know if I want to limit myself to just studying that one thing. And then I don't actually know if I want to work with that,
mm-hmm,
in the future. So I think I would definitely like to do something more broad.
Mm-hmm. And the liberal arts, what does that mean? Or what kind of subjects are they?
Yeah, so you get to choose between three majors, which are sciences, social sciences, and arts, typically. Like, and that's the three categories that most things are divided into. And so you can take kind of generally different courses, like things like you could do physics or maths, but you could also learn about like international relations or philosophy.
Okay, well, I'm so curious to see what happens and how many times you might change your mind. I mean, I think you started off, the first idea was that you were going to go to film school, and I was like, yeah, Emma would make a film that no one's ever made before. And then, oh, now I'm going to go and do, you look at aerospace engineering. I'm like, yeah, I can imagine Emma designing a rocket ship that no one's ever designed before. So anyway, watch this space, guys. Super fun. Now, going back to Montessori, I am a Montessori teacher, and what has it been like having a Montessori teacher as a mum?
I think it's generally really nice, because like it feels like you don't really like get angry at me often. There's definitely like mostly the whole non-violent communication thing and stuff, and teaching us to be independent as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're a seriously good baker. Well, you became a really good baker because I was baking with you when you were really small.
Yeah,
so you learned independent skills like that. And one of our favourite things is reading. Mm-hmm. Have you read anything lately that you enjoyed?
I read The Picture of Dorian Gray last year, which I really liked. More recent, I read this book called The Silence of the Girls, which was about the women in the Trojan War.
Oh.
And I really liked that one.
Yeah. You don't hear about women in history very often,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. I thought that was really interesting.
And actually, it's quite interesting because you are bilingual. You can read books in English and Dutch. Do you have a preference between...
I definitely prefer English. I think, like, I can read Dutch, but, like, if I read Dutch, you know, just the books I prefer are generally in English. And when they get translated, it's, like, I'd rather just read the original one.
Mm. That's quite interesting. And how do you feel about being bilingual?
I like it. Yeah.
Are you equally comfortable speaking English, Dutch?
I think so, yeah. Sometimes there's, I do have that thing where you know a word in one language but not the other.
Mm-hmm.
So then you just have to hope that the people you're talking to are also better.
And I think, like, we speak English at home and then you go to school in Dutch. And we have some friends who we speak Dutch with, and we have friends who we speak English with, and it is kind of confusing. But we also like to sometimes choose some Dutch words, like bedoeling is such a nice Dutch word, which is kind of like, and the intention of this word is, and so sometimes we just throw in a Dutch word.
Or like gezellig.
Gezellig, yeah, that means kind of cozy, but not really. It's just...
Yeah, it's just different.
It's just a nice word. We do try and keep to just English. But do you remember learning? You know, you were 4 when we moved here.
Yeah, I do remember some, like, funny moments, like the moment when my teacher asked me, like, if I knew what I don't know was in Dutch, because my reaction to just everything was just a shrug, or just moments where I got confused because I didn't understand what people were saying, and I didn't know if they were just being vague about something, or if I actually wasn't understanding them correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be a bit confusing sometimes, but...
Yeah, I think so. And you were 4 when we moved here, and so people often ask you, like, do you feel more Australian, or do you feel Dutch, or citizen of the world?
I was thinking about that recently, and I think I feel the most like Amsterdam, kind of. Mm. Like, I don't really relate to all of the, like, the whole cheese and windmills stereotype at all, but I think I feel the most, like... Amsterdam-ish.
I think also Amsterdam is unique, like, and as a teenager in Amsterdam you get quite a lot of independence. Like, I know my friends in Australia, they have to drive their kids places because Australia, the cities are very big and they have sport in different places and it's not always possible to get public transport or it takes a lot longer. And here we really, well, we didn't just say here's a bike and cycle across. We took time to, you know, cycle with you through the city when you were smaller and gradually built up. And I remember the last year before you started high school, you would cycle just 5 minutes ahead of me and I'd drive, cycle past the school to check you got there okay and things like that. And then that was when you got a mobile phone so that you could check if... I don't think you ever had to call to say, like, you had a puncture or anything. So. Yeah. And so then by high school, you were really cycling yourself to school and you just asked me, like, what time do I need to be home by? And I'd just tell you when dinner is.
Yeah.
So in some ways, that is a nice part.
Yeah, I think it's really nice.
Mm. And even, like, we kind of... You don't really have a curfew, but I don't like you cycling through the city much after 10 o'clock by yourself. Yeah. And so when I say, oh, I can come and, you know, cycle back with you, you always just go, and don't worry, I'll just come back by 10. So you're, like, the easiest teenager ever. It's like I've never had to argue with you about a curfew or anything like that. And then occasionally you've had a school party where it's, like, till 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not very good at staying up till 1 o'clock. So sometimes you come back with friends and things like that. But, you know, then, of course, you can stay out till 1 o'clock because it's a school party. So it's not like that happens every night of the week.
No, definitely not.
So that feels pretty good, too. And so I had some random questions at the end. Things like, do you consider yourself an introvert?
I think I'm very introverted around people that I don't know well.
Mm.
But when I know someone very well, then I can get quite loud sometimes.
Yeah.
It just depends on who I'm with. Yeah. But mostly I would say I'm an introvert.
Did you find that awkward? I mean, you were a little kid with these cute blonde curls and everyone wanted to touch your hair. And here you are, this introvert going, can I not be the centre of attention right now?
Yeah, I think I have trouble with being the centre of attention.
I used to always feel like I translated for you, like, oh, it looks like Emma doesn't want you to touch her curls right now. Or, Emma, will you let us know when you feel comfortable to talk? And I didn't want to label you shy, and I don't think you've become shy, but introverts just take some... You feel shy sometimes?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I also think you've got a very healthy sense of humour. You once wrote a parody about my book, and I was trying to find it before the call, but I couldn't put my hand on it somewhere. Do you remember what I said?
Yeah. I think I remember something. I don't remember exactly.
You don't remember? Yeah. Emma, we have a typewriter down... in this extra room downstairs, and
I could just write it because, like, it's been repaired recently, so
okay,
I'm gonna write it almost again. And I thought, what should I write? And I thought, I'll make a mini parody of Mum's book.
So it started off the Montessori toddler, and then it made something like, don't do this to your kid, enter an aubergine here.
Yeah, because you had all the drawings that you made of, like, I don't know, just random vegetables and things as well.
Yes, it was sweet. Anyway, we have fun with it. You don't offend me, but it's like Emma has a very sweet sense of humor, so maybe she'll become a satirist instead. And then, you know, you are the second child, and when you were small, I think you were 6 weeks old, and I had a checkup at the early childhood center, and they asked me if I was worried about anything, and I just said, I'm just worried that I'm not spending enough time with her. Then you were, like, in the meantime watching Oliver darting around the room as he was running across, and they said, like, look, she's also got Oliver, like, that she's watching him, and, you know, she's part of the family and all of that. And I guess I just wanted to acknowledge that now that Oliver's at a particular university, we've spent a lot of time together.
Yeah.
And we've become very close. Sometimes I think you're my flatmate. And on Wednesday nights, Emma cooks for me, or cooks for us. What did you cook last Wednesday? It was good.
I don't know how to pronounce it, tagine?
Oh, yeah, the Moroccan tagine. Yeah, that was good. And then the mushroom risotto.
Mm-hmm.
Vegan mushroom risotto. It's very cool. Yeah, since Emma's been doing her climate-friendly food, we're eating a bit more vegan.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting, right? It's good. And I just, like, enjoy having breakfast, talking a lot with you. Yeah. We have some super interesting conversations. We cover pretty much everything.
Yeah, I think so.
If I've been listening to a podcast, Emma has to hear about it. Oh, I was listening to a podcast and...
Yeah.
Any other fun things to talk about?
I don't know. I don't think there's anything in particular.
Maybe you can come back onto the podcast another time. Thanks, Emma, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I hope you enjoyed that little chat with Emma. And now over to my conversation with Oliver.
Hi, Oliver. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Thank you for doing this on your weekend back in Amsterdam from university.
Yeah, no worries.
Thank you. I thought it would be a good place to start with your childhood. And when you were born in Australia, but we're now living in Amsterdam, and we moved when you were about five. But do you remember anything about Australia or what you liked to do when you were a little kid?
Well, not very much. I don't remember much at all because I was small. But, I mean, I remember I liked it in Australia, and I liked the birthday parties we had.
We basically often just invited friends around to run around the backyard, I think.
Yeah, I like that.
and either I or Dad made a birthday cake.
Yeah, Dad made these very extravagant birthday cakes.
Yeah, like trains and houses and I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Very impressive. And going for bushwalks and things, do you remember doing bushwalks in Australia?
Well, when we visit Australia nowadays, I remember those bushwalks, but not... from when I was a kid.
Yeah. I've got some really cute photos of you being so small.
I mean, I remember when we went to the UK once. We went for a bushwalk in the UK and split my lip open.
Oh, yeah. That was a Puzzle Wood.
Yeah.
It's a great place to visit if anyone's there, but just don't split your lip open. You needed some stitches and things. That was exciting. Yeah, why do we only remember negative things?
I don't know.
But do you think it was a pretty happy childhood?
I think it was a happy childhood, yeah, generally.
Yeah. Do you remember, like, a little baby Emma?
No, just that she's always been there.
Yeah, because there's only 16 months between you guys, mm-hmm. So I guess that, I don't remember there being much sibling rivalry at the beginning. You just, like you say, I think mm-hmm. she's always been there. I think it's also been interesting seeing your relationship over the years because when you were small, you spent a lot of time playing together from quite a young age.
Mm-hmm.
And then through the teenage years, you kind of became less interested in spending time together. And now that you're at university and when you're back, it's nice to see you like just chatting when you're back. And
yeah, we don't necessarily spend time together now. We just chat if we happen to be in the same room.
Yeah. I mean, we sometimes play some board games, but not so often anymore.
Yeah.
We still spend some fun times together. I like when you're back in the house. It makes me appreciate your time when you're back here a lot.
Yeah, I often have things to do, but like lots of other work and, well, yeah, school work.
And you come to also do some sport, you do your martial arts.
Yeah, so that all takes time, but then I also like to relax, watch Netflix.
Yeah, it's cool. And one of my favourite things when you're back is still the same as when you were growing up as well, is having breakfast together. So
yeah,
before you go to sport, it's nice to connect, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we digress. Okay, memories about Montessori. So you went to Montessori school from well, we went to a play group, then you went to preschool from 3 to 6, mm-hmm. then we, well, we moved country and you finished your Montessori here at 12, right?
Yeah.
So what are some nice things that you remember about Montessori school?
I remember liking the fact that we weren't lined up, like with seating in a...
In rows kind of thing.
In rows, we were placing groups. And, you know, if I didn't like my classmates, I wasn't too big of a fan of the groups, but I did prefer that. And the fact you're free to move around, that's probably the biggest positive.
You could choose what you felt like doing, depending on the moment and the day. Yeah, and sometimes you work by yourself and sometimes with a friend, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that was nice as well. So if you don't feel like doing something, you could do it with a friend or do something else until you get the motivation for the thing to do.
And you could also go and visit the library, or do, were there any times of the day that you could do that?
I think you were allowed to just generally go to the library. I think we might have had like a library card. We had a toilet card as well. If someone's on the toilet, they have the toilet card. There's one and two, so that not everyone's going to the toilet at once. You put the toilet card back when you're done with it, and then you can pick up the toilet card.
Yeah,
it's toilet. So then that's the same thing with the library.
It's clever, right? Because it's a way of saying you can go to the toilet anytime you want, but we're not going to have like 5 kids mucking around in the toilet. So here's a couple of cards, and then we know that there's... So it's a very clever way that Montessori classes use to control the movement of the children. And similarly with the library card, they probably give it to you so they know who's in and out of the classroom.
Yeah.
And even I really liked at your school, there was like that atrium kind of place, so you could be in the classroom, but there was also space to spread out on those stairs and things in between the classrooms. Do you remember that?
We never really did anything there except for a couple of plays once a year. We never really spread out up there unless we had a creative project we had to work on. I do remember we had outside the classroom door, you had like a little bench as well as by the windows in the classroom where you can work together.
Oh yeah.
But then I especially liked sitting outside the classroom for a bit, just
change of scenery.
Yeah. Have a change of scenery, yeah.
That must feel quite strange to people who went to a traditional school and the teachers in standing in front of the classroom telling everyone what they're going to do. And actually, it's quite organic. Like, even though no one's telling you, it's not complete chaos. You know what the sequence of work is and what you're expected to do.
Of course, yeah. You have a booklet of things you have to have done by the end of the year, pretty much.
I guess that's the tricky part of Montessori, too, is having to plan, and, like, some days you don't feel so motivated.
Yeah, they had a special planning booklets for kids who struggled to plan, but I never had that, so I'm not sure how they did it. And then they'd also look in your booklet, see how far you are, and then if they say, okay, well, you have to do this still.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And so I'm curious, so you went to Montessori school up to 12, and then for your high school, it was a very classical school, actually. And I remember when you picked that... you know, I said, it's going to be much stricter. The teachers are going to tell you what you need to do. If you're late to class, then you're going to, get punished. And they don't have punishments in the Montessori school. They'll, like, kind of warn you, or they'll say, like, what's going on. They'll try and find a way to get you to school on time. And I remember you saying something like, well, I think it's a stupid rule, but it'll be fine. And then, like, you were hardly ever late for school. It was only if you'd... I can't even remember you being very late at all. But do you remember any differences, like, moving into the... traditional high school, was that a big difficult shift for you?
Not at all. I thought I didn't find it difficult at all. By the time I was finished with primary school, I feel like I was kind of done with Montessori as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious what the traditional school was like, and I also felt that could maybe help me be more productive because with Montessori you just have days of not being productive sometimes, and I was curious about homework and
I was curious about
how bad is homework? It, like, if I have nothing to do at home, I may as well work, right?
Yeah.
And of course, within 2 months of high school, I was done with homework. I didn't want it anymore.
How did you find, like, then having to have tests and things like that in high school? Because there's much more tests in high school, right?
I was very motivated for the tests in the first year, especially. I studied a lot for them, and I got high marks because I don't think I've ever really had a test before, and I enjoyed the challenge. So I actually did like to challenge myself and, oh, okay, there's quite a lot of tests, but that was all right. It's not very fun, but...
Were you happy with your results in the end, though?
I was pretty happy, yeah. I know I could have done better, but
yeah,
I just didn't put in enough work to do better, and I passed anyway.
So. You passed, yeah. You've got into the study that you wanted to do as well.
Yeah.
So tell us about that, because I guess I was surprised at the study you chose, we can talk about. But yes, what did you choose?
I chose to do applied mathematics and technical computer science, a double bachelor, and now it's my second try. But
Oliver had some health issues last year, so he started the first year again this year.
Yeah, but now I chose the bachelor in the first case, I think mostly for the applied mathematics. That was the thing that interested me most.
Mm.
But then I saw, okay, you can do technical computer science on the side. That's interesting. I've never really done something with computers before, so I may as well give that a try. And then I enjoyed the computer science more than the mathematics, and I stopped with mathematics.
What's it like being at uni? Do you like it?
Yeah, I like it. It's much more... I guess there's more freedom as well, because they're not going to force you to come to the...
Like lectures and tutorials.
Tutorials, yeah. You just have to organize it yourself. There are a couple of mandatory things you actually have to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And to, like, you know, the tests, obviously, but also for some courses you need a certain amount of hours presence.
Mm-hmm.
But they give you that freedom yourself. So if you have a lecture recorded in mind and you look at the lecture slides and you think, okay, I understand this and I want to sleep in.
Mm.
Or you wake up in the morning and you think, no, not feeling it. You don't actually have to go.
Yeah.
You can just have a lie in for a bit more. And of course, it's your own responsibility to catch up. But
yeah,
it's gone fine so far.
Yeah. And socially, it's nice, right? You are on some committees at mm-hmm. your university. You do sport. You have a girlfriend. You're sharing a house with a couple of friends.
Yeah, and socially there's lots, but I think that's a part of being a student as well.
Yeah, fun.
I'm still finding a balance because I haven't been doing this for very long at all.
Yeah.
But I think once I have a balance, it'll be much nicer.
And, you know, you've actually been very independent because you live 3 hours away, so you have to organize mm-hmm. everything yourself. I remember, like, within a week or so, you'd organize the internet connection and installed the modem, all these kind of things that you just got on and organized. You have to organize your study financing and things yourself. How's that been? Like,
yeah, it's been fine. I also feel free to ask you guys if I don't know something, like how to do my health insurance. I didn't know how to do that, and Dad helped me with that.
Yeah.
And I'm now switched to my own health insurance, which is really nice. But yeah, generally doing things on my own, you just have to do them. So you get on with it and you learn.
Yeah. And I mean, you guys also, rather than just eating takeaway food, you really actually cook proper meals. You take turns to cook. You make sure you clean the house before you leave on the weekends. Yeah. I really like hearing that you're pretty responsible.
We're not perfect.
No, of course. Is anyone?
No, but we mostly try and cook ourselves. But of course, once every couple of weeks, if we don't feel like cooking, we'll get takeaway, or like especially on a Friday evening, if we're all in Enschede and we have to still travel, or we're waiting to travel, and we have to eat at home, then no one really feels like cooking, so we'll just get something, or we'll eat leftovers.
Yeah.
And the cleaning, of course, also. We try to do it every week, but then, you know, we won't do it perfectly every week.
But you have plants, and they're still alive?
They're miraculously still alive.
It's very sweet. So I think the reason I say that I was surprised about your study is because when you were growing up, you were a kid, if I could make a generalization, who was very caring and thoughtful of other people. So even when Emma was a little baby, you were quite helpful and looking after her. A friend of ours homeschooled their son, and every week you'd go and visit him, and you did a lot of bailes, which is like tutoring for other kids. Even in your pukulon, your martial arts classes, you're always giving lessons, almost from the second you started giving lessons to younger kids. And so I had this idea that you would go into something to do with care, and
it's not care, no, it's, but I'm not convinced I want to do something with IT at all, or with computers. Having a bachelor is handy, and I like the idea of programming, so I'd like to learn programming, learn more about computers, and if that takes me on a career path, then that's fine by me. But there's also other things that interest me. Yeah, I like teaching. I would actually like to be a teacher, maybe. I don't know. And I enjoy my football and my sports. If I can combine IT and something like teaching and or sports, then that would be fine with me, because I'm pretty sure I'm not gonna get a job in IT when I'm gonna be programming all day.
Yeah,
because that's just not
fun kind of thing. Yeah. And so the people listening to this podcast are interested in Montessori.
Yeah.
And I'm a Montessori parent, I guess. Mm-hmm. What has it been like having a mum who's a Montessori teacher?
Well, I've taken it for granted, of course. I don't know how it would be to have a different mum than...
Has it mostly been positive?
I think it's been mostly positive. I don't have any feelings like, oh no, I resent my mum for this and that. There's no resentment at all.
Yeah.
It's been a good childhood generally.
Oh, well, okay, that's good then. Also, I think people would be probably curious. The Netherlands is known for, you know, being quite ahead of its time in terms of sex education and things. And I was always happy that you were at Dutch schools where it's very matter of fact, honest. People don't hide away from truth. They give age-appropriate answers and things like that to questions. And I remember you having a lesson once about sexually transmitted diseases. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was a very strange lesson, but they turned the classroom into a bit of a like club in a way. And they gave you a cup of milk.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to walk around that. You had to walk around with that. And then you had to have interactions with other people, you know, and then you kind of mix the milk and then pour it back into the cups, and that went on for a few minutes, and then by the end of it, you all had like a character card that said you were or weren't allowed to do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So mine wasn't allowed to refuse any of those interactions because he was too scared.
Mm-hmm.
So and then by the end of it, we had to sit in a circle with the milk, and then there was one of the cups. One of the cups wasn't milk. It was, I think, set meal. What's set meal?
Set meal. I don't. Oh, maybe cornstarch or something.
Like some kind of solution. If you added a blue substance, it would react and turn blue.
Uh huh.
And that represents an STD. And then, so if you didn't mix with the cornstarch, you would get white.
Yeah.
And if you did, you'd get a blue cup. And like everyone except for two people didn't get a blue cup. It was like, you know, it was a lesson that it can spread quickly.
Yeah.
Like in even one night. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. They use kind of playful ways of trying to share messages.
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's awkward. Like, and the teachers are doing their best to make it not awkward, and they just make it more awkward. But it's okay for it to be awkward as well. It's.
Yeah.
Also important to learn about it.
Yeah, and I think that in the Netherlands they have one of the lowest teen pregnancy rates because people are aware of it. And I think there's less dating. Really, people have their first sexual experiences with girlfriends and boyfriends, people who they're really in love with. And I think that that's only a positive thing.
Yeah, I also think that generally would differ per level of education because I was in a high level of education. There, of course, you quickly see like, okay, oh, well, you have better understanding, of course, of the consequences of not being safe about it, and then maybe in a lower education they would, they'd be less aware of the consequences, and they'd be quicker to not use protection.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. It's to do with education and family education and social and economic things play a role. Mm-hmm. So they're definitely all good points. And also another thing that I found surprising is when you were a teenager that you really wanted to get a job. And I'm like, you know, it's okay. You don't need to earn money. Like, you're living at home. But you worked at the cinema for at least a couple of years, I think.
Yeah, I think it's like 1.5 years. Yeah. I mean, I understand what you mean now in that the amount of money I earned with the job.
Oh, we should say that like the minimum wage here is 3 or 4 euros an hour.
Yeah, I was definitely getting under 5 euros an hour. And I was working quite a lot. But even then, like, the amount of money I ended up saving up is pretty insignificant in the grand scale of things.
But it was that desire to earn your own money, and I think it's actually really interesting that motivates you to do it.
It was fun. It was also socially good. I made friends at Pathé.
And you even had a cinema pass, too.
I had a cinema pass, which was very handy in the 3 weeks to go and see the movies for free.
Yeah.
I did see a lot of movies.
Yeah.
No, I was very happy with the job.
I haven't really got any other questions for you.
Okay.
But I always enjoy your company. I think that's my favourite thing about you. And I am always, my heart, as I said, is full when you're home. And thank you for coming on the podcast. Is there anything else that you wanted me to ask you?
Don't think so. Yeah.
Okay.
so fun. It was so lovely to get them both on the podcast. That was very kind of them to both agree. And now here is my conversation with Luke, Oliver and Emma's dad, and we'll be talking about co-parenting.
Hi, Luke. Thanks for coming to be in the podcast today.
Hello.
Yes. Luke and I met, we worked out in 1998, September, and we were actually doing a film course, and we got hilariously paired up as partners.
Yeah.
And then by June 1999, that's less than a year later, we were married.
Yeah.
And you were then living on the other side of the world as well. You were living in London. Well, we were both living in London. Okay, so that's the background. Thanks for coming on. Luke and I, yes, we were married, and we were married for 17 years, and we are still family, even though we are no longer married. Yes, so I thought that it would be nice to invite Luke on to talk to you about that today. But I guess one part of it is that he's been also married to a Montessori teacher, and I wonder what that's kind of like, and if you feel like you've become a Montessori dad as a result.
Well, I always think back to that when we were looking for that first preschool or nursery for Oliver, and seeing the difference between, let's say, a playgroup where there were some rather frazzled looking people trying to manage a big room full of kids with plastic toys and a lot of noise, and the contrast then with the Montessori environment, which I think we both really liked immediately. It seemed very calm and very organized, and the kids seemed so happy and independent and interested in what they were doing. So in that sense, I think from that moment, it was like, oh yeah, I can really get on board with the idea of it.
Yeah. Do you think of a Montessori more as a schooling thing or also how we parented them?
I think that we were both quite enthusiastic about it. I know I was enthusiastic about thinking that they could follow that in their education. So I guess that was the primary focus, is thinking about what schooling options we made. And then as you became more interested in it and started applying it at home, then that was really like an interesting process, and seeing, thinking about like the choices we were making and so I think the home environment was secondary, but it was also really interesting to see how it came about, because of course they did all those little activities at their first school, didn't they? They did their sewing and things like that, and then of course you could do those activities at home, and that was really sweet, perhaps things that we hadn't thought of.
And even just like getting them involved cooking and things like that much younger.
Yeah.
That cute. Yeah, we had the stepladder in our kitchen and the kids preparing their own snack.
Yeah. I mean, that was always, that's always one that I remember, is that photograph of Emma making her own crackers. How old was she then? A year?
Yeah, she's 16 months old. Right. She's actually spreading a honey sandwich at the top of the, at the top of the ladder. Yeah. Unfortunately, she's got no clothes on.
Yeah. So things like that were lovely to see. And I remember when we built the cubby house, you know, I remember Oliver using the hammer to hammer in the real nails and stuff. So I mean, he was probably 18 months or two or something, was he? I don't know. At that point, he was very tiny, but he wanted to help. And, you know, and then he realised that they're capable of helping. That was really lovely.
But one thing to say is that actually, I don't know if I would have got into Montessori had it not been for you, actually, for a few reasons. One is that when I started going to the Montessori playgroup with Oliver and Emma, I was saying how interested I was, and you picked up and fed back to me that I was really enjoying it, and you noticed how much I was wanting to learn about it. And then when I said, you know, I was thinking of doing the Montessori training, you were really supportive of that, and it involved quite a lot of logistics that affected you and your work. And you were doing shift work, looking after the kids during the day while I was off doing study for certain periods. Do you remember all that crazy time?
Yeah, I remember it. And I don't, it's funny, isn't it? Like, time makes you look back on things and think like, oh, it wasn't that big a deal. But of course, then I said this out loud to someone quite recently. I was saying about how we'd done that thing. So I thought, so what was the arrangement? Basically, there were periods where you were studying full time and you were attending the courses.
Yeah, they were like in 6-week blocks.
Yeah.
Through the space of 2 years almost. Yeah.
And so I'd had this arrangement at work where a guy agreed to do all my day shifts so that I could go on to a permanent night shift. But that's an evening shift. So I would get home about 1:30 or something. And then I would sleep a bit and then do the kids during the day and That was I don't remember that daytime being challenging at all. I think that, you know, and then it was just a discipline for a short period, wasn't it?
Yeah, and what was good was it was in blocks, so you kind of through that. And that, we were also living in Sydney at the time, so my parents were around. I can't remember how much they helped or not, but I'm sure they had
their day a week, didn't they? Your mother had a special day a week that she had the kids, so that was always good. And then, I think that, it wasn't a choice that was permanent, and so then it made sense. Because, you know, there were also, of course, lots of times where you picked up a lot of slack for me, you know, and so it felt like there was a good give and take. It felt like the appropriate thing to do, you know, for that short period. All those, how long was it? Was it 2 years?
I think by the time we finished, a year and a half to 2 years. Right. Yeah.
So again, recognizing that, like, oh yeah, this is your opportunity to do that thing, and
That was 2004, 2005.
Right.
Yeah. So the kids were still pretty small. Emma's two. Oliver's 3, 4,
I remember, for example, one of the things that I remember being very pleased about was, I mean, it was only a little thing, but the day that Emma like fell over and banged her head in the playground when she was with your mother.
Okay.
And you were studying, and it was your mum's special day, and your mother was trying to manage the situation, but Emma only wanted her daddy, so I had to drop everything and go to the hospital. And I just thought, like, Emma loves her daddy, so that was, you know, evidence of that. Your mother phoned me somewhat reluctantly and said, okay, I can't come there, and she just really wants you to come.
I think it's interesting because I feel like with teenagers, yes, you do have to do a lot less, but I like being around the house because there's just those moments when you're in the kitchen table and they plonk down and then you're like, oh yeah, I'll just sit here and for as long as they're going to chat for, and it's being around for when you just need them, but they're much more independent.
This also came up for me just recently as somebody asked me to do something, and I said, no, I want to be around for Emma this week because she's studying and things like that. And this why she's old enough to be on her own. I said, well, it's not a question of that. I have a whole week when she's not staying with me to do my stuff, and that's where I'll put it, and then I can just be around for that.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good point to step off and talk about co-parenting.
Yes.
Because for the last few years, we were separated for a couple of years. Then I think it was around 2018, 17 that we divorced, and you bought your apartment.
Well, I'm afraid.
Please correct me. I have no idea.
Yeah, it's longer than that, actually.
Is it?
We divorced in 2016, and we've been separated for 2 years before that.
Yeah, well, we were living in the same house. That's kind of controversial, but it worked. And then everyone was happy when we actually had our own spaces. And then you bought an apartment, which is 10 minutes cycle away. So actually for the kids, they can just cycle between the houses. They were old enough. It's a complicated time separating because it's not all joy. It's some sadness. But we made some rules, and I think they really worked to our advantage. Things like we said we would be kind about each other in front of the children, and if we had things to vent, we'd keep that for other times or for friends or for a therapist or something like that.
For me, maybe even it might be worth saying that for me, I was around 11 when my parents separated, and Emma was at a similar age when we separated. And it was really important to me at the beginning that we be open about it, because my parents were awful about telling us what was going on, and it was either a complete lack of information or in a couple of cases misleading information. And
I will just quickly say they're lovely parents, but this was obviously an awkward thing. Were just trying to,
I really think that also a product of their time, that, you know, that there was a taboo around it. We lived in a rural area, you know, they were subject to gossip and things like that. I think that must have been a very painful thing, but these are only things that I've thought about when I was an adult.
Yeah.
Faced with the choices that they made, I thought it was important to me that when we realised that we wanted to separate and made that decision, that the kids know about that straight away, and we tell them that we would keep them involved. And I remember that conversation was difficult, but it was also pretty good. You know, the result was that we all got to have a hug at the end, and I still remember that Emma had said, well, if everybody's happier, then it's going to be a good thing. And I really appreciated it because, like, my experience was thinking that there was great shame on my family when my parents divorced, mm-hmm. that I couldn't even talk about this at school. But of course, now the children are exposed to so many different types of families and can see that these things are a part of life.
Mm-hmm.
I think we both had the will to make it as
amicable
as possible and not go through some sort of acrimonious divorce where we both had lawyers who would sue each other and having some guidance from the lawyer. From the lawyer about the co-parenting contract and how that works and matters around respect were sort of in line with our own ideas about it. So that was quite nice. So we had a basis.
I think the hardest thing, though, is that we didn't really have any example of other people who were in a positive place with someone that they're divorced from. My experience of divorce with people who had grown up in separate, like with parents that had separated, and it was acrimonious, and the children had to ferry messages between the parents and different things like that, and that it wasn't necessarily a positive thing, that you definitely weren't part of a family anymore, you know, this kind of thing. But I wanted Oliver and Emma to think, oh, this isn't a bad thing. Yeah, we're both happier. So basically, we decided, we're both idealists, and we're like, well, we're not really happy and super in love anymore, and is this meant to be the rest of our life? Well, yeah, actually, it's a painful process, and it took us 6 months, I think, to decide whether we were actually going to separate or we could work it out. We tried therapists. It wasn't working, so that was painful. And also, I think one of the most painful things for me was grieving the loss of the future, the plans that you've made for each other. Like, oh, what about that, like, glass cabin that we were ever going to build as old people, you know, and letting go of those things. But getting back to the co-parenting contract, I think that's really an interesting thing that they do in the Netherlands, is that they really make you set out what days of the week are you going to look after the children, who's responsible for this part of the financial picture, and you really have to set it out. And I even think that one of the clauses is that you're meant to be respectful of each other.
Yeah, I remember being struck by that, yeah.
So what kind of things do we now discuss about the kids that, you know, to keep us on the same page?
At this point, at the age they are now, so...
Well, even when they were a bit younger, because maybe people have younger kids who might be in a similar situation. Or, you know, this is also just, even if you're not co-parenting, this is stuff you should be talking about.
Well, I mean, I think it's evolved in parallel with the way that our relationship has evolved. So I feel like, so at the beginning, we had to be really careful about the way that we communicated, because I can remember... this went both ways, but I remember one day having a series of very quick emails from you, and I thought, by the end of reading them, I thought, oh, you're actually quite, I think you're angry. So I sort of used some of your techniques on you and just said, I think you're angry. And you said, yeah, I think I probably am angry. So let's come back to this subject when you're less angry. And, you know, and maybe we tried WhatsApp or maybe we tried calling, and suddenly it was like, okay, so there's a time for a particular time, a type of communication, a particular medium or a particular type of time of day. But what we found is, like, over time, so for example, now I think we can do sort of like, what do? We do kind of like casual inquiries over WhatsApp, but also we have a sort of friendly chat on WhatsApp as well. We can just have
We also have the family chat. So there's Oliver, Emma, Luke and I have one chat as well.
Yeah. And then urgent, we'll call, but I don't think that comes up very often.
We texted each other to say, have you got 5 minutes? I need to talk to you about something.
Yeah, yeah. Is that usually me having a breakdown?
Yeah, that's happened a couple of times.
And then business goes in email, but that's very rare. And then we have like a monthly coffee together, which is nice, and you know, it seems to be like now it's got to a point where it's half about the kids and half about us.
Yeah, just chatting catching about
up. What's going on and catching up. So that's really good. So I think that we went from a position of going like, well, how are we going to negotiate this co-parenting arrangement, to actually going like, oh, actually now we're friends again, and that's actually really amazing when you think about how the end of the marriage was, and not really being friends and not being really there for each other, I suppose, in some way. And now it feels like, oh, this is actually way better
I think what also I've noticed is that we have to support each other's mental states, because I recognize that if you're in a hard time, having a hard time, you know, you work freelance and sometimes you're super busy and you've got extra things, it's actually better for me to say, how can I help you? Because it actually helps the overall family. It means like, okay, you don't have as much time for the kids, so why don't I take them for the extra week of the holidays? You know, like, we've managed to work that out, where before it was very much, well, what extra day are you going to take then because you're not taking the kids? And it's really recognizing that we're supporting each other as a family. And maybe that's something that everyone needs to take away, is that you might have arrangements with your partner, but sometimes it has to be for the bigger picture.
Yeah, you can always fall back on the sort of idea that it's 50-50. But of course, we've just recognized that we're actually much more flexible with each other now as needs arise. So that's really been great. And that comes out of the fact that we're close and friends as a and functioning as a family better.
Well, one other thing that I was thinking about as well is me having to let go of some control as well, because I think that in our family, I was still the one that organized a lot of things, like the food, the meals. You did some cooking and that kind of thing, but I was definitely more on the organizing, the kids' activities, you know, just more the organizer. And I remember being at the lawyer one day, and there was something about you saying, you know, you're not going to be able to tell me what I can feed the kids. And I was just like, for a moment, what? Like, horrified. Like, oh my gosh, they might be eating pizza every day. And then I'm like, well, maybe they will eat pizza every day, but when they're in my house, I'll be able to feed them the home-cooked meals that I like to have. And I know they don't eat pizza every day at your house, because actually you're a better cook than I am.
It's true. The food thing came up. And I think, yeah, again, I mean, when you're in that sort of like tense environment with the lawyer sitting there, I think I was making probably more an intellectual point about the fact that, like, what the point of separating from somebody and divorcing them is that you don't influence or expect a right over what the other person does. For us, because we wanted to do it, you know, right, it was knowing that we could comment about these things but not have an expectation attached to it. So yeah, you didn't get to see what I cooked for them, but it wasn't a way of me facilitating giving them junk food every night, you know, because you know, that was not the intention. The point was to say, no, this is, and it was also around like holidays, you know, for example.
Well, actually, holidays is one thing that I think we've found difficult and had to work out. Like, since we've been co-parenting and we do switch holidays, I like to plan in advance, and also I have family on the other side of the world, so sometimes I want to coordinate with them. And so I might need to know a year out, and you were totally like, I need to know a week before what's happening with holidays. And so I remember saying, well, my parents want to meet up next year in, you know, whatever year it was, and you were like, I can't give you that information now. And I felt really frustrated, and then I realized, okay, well, how can we solve this? Actually, what's only important is for me to know which weeks of the holidays would work, and then you can do whatever you like with your holidays. So once we worked out what was, now a phrase that I use a lot is like, what's important to me is to know da da da, and then you kind of like, you can't deny that because it's important to me, but then you're open to hearing, like, then we actually can get down and solve the problem, as opposed to being attached to you agreeing or not agreeing to my kids going where, you know, or our kids going somewhere.
I think at the beginning that felt more important, and I think now that was what was important to you, and for me it was important not to think about what I'm doing in a year's time. Which, you know, I sometimes wish I could think that far ahead, but I don't. That's who I am. So but what I appreciated and what I acknowledged was the notion that what you were trying to do in terms of sharing holidays with your parents and going to Australia and things like that is logistically much more complex than what I was thinking about doing, which is, you know, maybe go see my family in the UK, it's much closer, or rent a car and go on a road trip and these sorts of things. So I understand that you needed to know much further in advance. So then it was like realizing that it was like, oh yeah, actually, why can't I be just flexible, give you the information that you need, which weeks, and then say, yeah, and beyond that, do whatever you like around the dates and times and things.
So I think that actually, which works in any relationship, which what you used to fight about maybe when we were married or when we were separating, was we were both fixed in like, I'm right and you're wrong. And then as over time we realized, oh, the relationship didn't work because it takes two people. And like, Luke was feeling abandoned because I wasn't watching TV with him and I was so busy working. And I was feeling frustrated because I wasn't feeling acknowledged and seen for all the madness that I was doing, running around looking after kids and, you know, running, doing things that were important to me. And so, but owning that responsibility, like, actually, it's not Luke's fault and it's not my fault. It's just that we could have done things better. And but it's actually good because we're both actually are happier now. And we really like our lives now. And the kids, like you've said, they know that too. Like, if I ever ask Oliver, what is it like having, you know, parents? Like, you guys are both happier, so we're happy. We're good.
I think one of the things that we discovered when we moved abroad was that then the time that we spent with our parents in the UK or Australia was much more focused and much more valuable
mm-hmm.
than perhaps that sort of like casual familiarity of living close to them. And now it became like, oh, we actually got to spend really good time with them. And I think, well, obviously we're moving into that with kids too. It's like we might have them for less,
mm-hmm.
but we get to have them. But then when we make that commitment and spend that time with them, then it's, you know, it's much more valuable.
Yeah, like over the holidays, we just had the New Year break and it was so lovely. Like the house was full, the kids were coming and going. Luke came over for Christmas Day and spent most of the day. You supplied the Lego and my sister was here with her kids. And yeah, it was pretty funny. So, I mean, partners, even the year before that, you had a girlfriend and Audrey was here for Christmas Day.
That's
and actually,
right,
I wanted to talk about Audrey because you were dating her for a couple of years and having another person in, you know, the family constellation, I guess. But I really liked how she always just said, like, that she was your girlfriend and she wasn't, like, their stepmother or... Plus, you weren't married or anything. But she said, you know, I know that you're a good mother. They don't need another mother. I mean, she could always, she was another person in their life. Like, they could always ask her and speak to her about things. But I liked that there was that...
Yeah, I think that... I mean, yeah, I mean, for me, it was never, there was never any question of it. It was, you know, we were just, she was my girlfriend and it was a great relationship. But she was, at the beginning, she voiced this to me as well, because I think, again, she wanted to just understand more about the nature of what was going on, because she'd never been in a relationship with somebody who had children before and quite old children. So I thought that was really smart of her to address it head on and vocalize what her process was, understanding that, you know. And she says, do I need to do this? Do I need to do that? And I was like, no, you don't have any responsibility or obligation to them whatsoever.
So I think that to wrap up, as we've been talking a long time, what we're still working on, I guess, is being safe, feeling like it's safe to be honest with each other, you know, but not offend each other. So I use a lot of nonviolent communication techniques with you, which sometimes I'm sure drives you crazy. But I think it's also meant that we can continue to have a positive relationship.
Yeah, I think for me, certainly when we were in that bad period of the relationship breaking up, and separating, and you had an interest in nonviolent communication, it felt like I wasn't ready for it at that point. It felt patronizing or controlling or something, right?
And to be honest, I had no idea what I was doing. So I was like trying to name your feelings and stuff like this, and it wasn't really authentic. And now I kind of understand it better, I think.
Right, yeah.
But when I say nonviolent communication, it might just be that you're getting frustrated about something that's happening, and instead of me just denying it and saying, well, you shouldn't feel that way, I kind of really let you talk it out. And then I maybe say, okay, and from my perspective or from the kid's perspective, maybe it looks like this. I don't know. What I'm just thinking is, like, when I was a 15-year-old, maybe I would have been thinking that. And then you've vented enough that you're actually able to hear that, take it on. Sometimes you do. Yeah, and you'd be like, okay, that's valuable. All right, think about that.
Subsequently, there's kind of like, there's a couple of things at the moment. One is that, like, so because you're interested in it, I've looked in a little bit into nonviolent communication. I know some other people who are doing that. Then there's another thing which is probably related, or there's some crossover, that I know a couple of people who are practicing radical honesty.
Oh, yeah.
And then that's really interesting to me, because I sort of like, you know, rather glibly thought to myself, well, I've been trying to do that for years and it just gets me into trouble.
I think that's what you said when I saw put my post on Instagram that I was practicing radical honesty. Like, that just gets you in trouble when you say the truth. I'm like, yeah, but you have to be sensitive to, like, how someone else is going to receive it.
Yeah,
it's not just saying it bluntly. It's,
yeah.
There's ways.
And so there's that. And then there's also a thing where I think, like, oh, actually, it's been a roller coaster, you know, recognizing that the marriage could break down, we could separate, but also that it could be a positive outcome. And then the subsequent relationship of you know, and having experiences that are negative, and then another relationship experience that was positive, and feeling like, oh, actually, yeah, maybe I'm just getting old. Maybe I recognize that there is some, finally, there's some emotional maturity kicking in, and maybe my own thing around doing Vipassana and meditation, where you could go, okay, I can not attach, I recognize that this is attachment. So as I've made these inquiries, I sort of think like, okay, now I really respect what you've done around the way that you've tried to communicate and the way that that process is going. So sometimes I don't even notice you're doing it. And sometimes I do notice you're doing it and it doesn't drive me crazy anymore. But what's also fun is then I can have a conversation with Emma in which maybe we can deconstruct the idea of, we can be playful with it. So we can say, what would Simone say in this situation, right? So we can be playful with that. And so in a sense, we nonviolent communication is one thing. We say like, oh, but on the other hand, let's say that recently you and Emma have been interested in Ayurvedic food and things like that, and changes in lifestyle and things like that. But when Emma talks about that to me, she says the hippie doctor, which is really cute, right? So what we can do is we can be sincerely interested in the benefits of something, but also have a playful layer and around it. And so when you said to me, I think, was it radical honesty or nonviolent communication? You said, oh, I've been doing that on you for months. And it was like, oh, I went, oh yeah, but I don't feel like I'm being manipulated. I think
really important to, you're not manipulating them. Yeah. And actually this is something I wanted to talk about. Like the last thing is that the regret I have is that maybe we didn't model conflict resolution in front of the kids because we didn't have examples of people who were able to have conflict in a positive way, because I think conflict's good, like to have two people who have different opinions. But because of that, holding on to I'm right and you're wrong instead of like, oh, I'm curious, tell me more about that, oh, and maybe it even comes to a better solution, or someone realizes, oh yeah, okay, actually that does make more sense than what I was saying. You know, and I don't think that when we were married we necessarily always modeled for the kids that, which is something I was trying to in siblings, you know, I was always saying, you know, saying it, but I wasn't modeling, and they're watching more how we react. And sometimes I guess we kept out things that we wanted to discuss to other times, or I didn't speak up when something made me uncomfortable, you know. So I think that that's something I've learned, and now hopefully with this more open communication where we can say what we think but we're respecting each other, and yeah, it's kind of cool. And I hope that people will take that away from listening to the podcast today, even if they're not in a co-parenting situation. They might be with other partners or with family. It works on family, it works on little people, it works on big people. So yeah, try it out. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you wish we had spoken about?
That's a nice way of putting it. There's so much, isn't there? There's like, I could talk for hours, but yeah, no, it's really good. I think the modeling thing is interesting because I always remember from very early on a parenting book from Steve Bidulph saying that you're not the child's friend. You're not your child's friend, you're their parent. Mm-hmm. And that distinction was very important. And there was a lot of talk at the time in Australia about this notion that even in the vernacular, you say to your children, mate, come on, mate. You know, fathers and sons they'll call them mate, which means friend. And so it was this idea that maybe they're trying to be too friendly and not parenting.
Mm.
So when you talk about modelling, it's kind of a thing like, now that the children are older, I can recognise that like we can model authenticity around the positive stuff, but also around the struggles that we're having. It's like, oh, you know, I don't feel that great and all the rest of it. When they're younger, I think maybe there's an idea of like we have to appear stoic and functional. Mm. And what we discover as we grow older is that our parents were kind of making it up as they go along. And certainly in the case of my parents divorcing, for example, they were very unskilled. Mm. And we could be more skilled. And so this idea that there's progression in that we're doing our best, that we can do our best, we can choose to be open and more of it and model that more. It's kind of like, yeah, you can't know it all at the beginning, but the older we get, maybe the better we're getting at it. And that's still a process.
Something I remember we spoke about as well is that like I often tell Emma all my vulnerable things, the things I've done wrong and how I'm working through them, like to And that's basically what you're saying. It's like, actually, but I kind of agree and disagree. I do think that I'm mostly friends with Oliver and Emma, but there's moments when I have to step and be the parent and set this line. And that's, I think, really nice, because if I didn't have a connection and a friendship with them, then it's really hard to set the limit and be the parent. But I do think some people forget to be the parent and set the limit. Yeah.
No, I feel friendly and affectionate and close to the kids too. It's not about not having that, but it's about remembering that you are the parent. You're responsible in that sense. But also I don't need to burden them. I can tell them what's going on, but I don't need to burden them. They shouldn't perhaps be my confidant, about something that's very sensitive. I can't, they've got enough to deal with.
I thought of one more thing. We're never going to end this conversation. Sorry, everyone. What was it? Age appropriate. All of the communication we had with the children was age appropriate. So when we're separating, we don't air everybody's laundry, and say we just give them age appropriate information, but we were very honest with the information we always gave them. And that was true about things that were changing with their bodies, right through to, us separating, being honest with what was happening and how we were feeling. But I didn't have to tell them every feeling that I was having, because I can give that to my friends and my family. I did see a therapist for 7 times. That was really helpful as well.
Yeah, that's really good, yeah.
And the other thing I also remember to say is I love Brené Brown's thing, and she says, when you say that, what I'm thinking is, and you sometimes Luke will say a comment that's completely harmless, but I'll take it as a judgment or a personal affront. And then so I'll be like, oh, by the way, when you said that, this was what made me think. And he'd be like, oh, no, that wasn't the intention at all. But by airing it and being honest about what my fears are, that's been really helpful. Okay. Luke is actually, one of the cleverest people I know. Thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for being an awesome co-parent. And I think we're doing okay.
I think so too. Yeah. I'm enjoying this period. Right. And thanks for having me. This was great.
So I hope you found that fun, meeting my family. And now we have our first listener question. The question is, Montessori tools seem so expensive now. Any ideas to implement Montessori in a low-income household? Thanks for your question, Lily. Yes, I have some ideas. I really think that this question resonates a lot for me, because the materials are lovely. The activities, seeing a child focus deeply on something that they're working to master when you see that repetition is really, really beautiful. But I also think that can also be created by making those materials yourself. So if you're at all handy, then that's even better, because you might want to use wood and actually make things. But even for a toddler who's learning to post coins into a coin box, if you don't want to buy the coin box, you could use an old shoe box and cut a slit out of that, and then you could post large coins and then practice the same skill again and again. I've also made marble runs out of old toilet rolls, and you tape them onto the walls, you cut them in half, and it's actually like a lesson in physics. Oh, it didn't quite get on, and you can use a ping pong ball, a table tennis ball, to make it go down, which is really fun as well. So, you definitely need to be creative, but it is possible to sometimes look at what are they trying to practice, and can I create that with materials that I have at home? And also, use what you already have. So if someone gave you a plastic toy, it may not be specifically Montessori, but if your child's focused on it, you might be able to adapt it even. Some of these shape sorters, for example, are really lovely, but they're way too complicated for a very young child. So you can simplify it by taking out all of the extra shapes and just starting with the cylinder, because there's no edges on it. That's the easiest to post. So you'll also get more longevity out of the toys that you do have if you look at how can I simplify it, and then also how can I make it more challenging as my child gets older. So if you are ever going to make a purchase, you can actually choose those things that we'll use for a long time by being able to be modified. And then I like to say that it's not all about the materials living in a Montessori way. It's really this respectful communication, respecting the child, seeing where they're at, accepting them for who they are on their unique path, on their unique journey. And even if they were at Montessori school, it's actually not recommended to have any of those Montessori materials at home once they're above 3, because once they're in a Montessori school, they're not going to be as engaged if they've got the same materials at home, and also you might present them in a way that's different to the way that they're learning it in their classroom from their teacher, so it can actually be confusing. So don't think that you have to have those beautiful red rods and things in your home. It's actually better for them to, you know, be at school and be engaged in learning there. And then you do all of those things like exploring nature with your child, which can be completely free. It might be as simple as finding a playground down the road, or you might have somewhere which has got a forest and you can go walking through the woods. You may be near a seaside, because that can be really beautiful to play at the beach. And these things can be completely free. So don't forget those. You just need some rain boots, I guess. So find some secondhand boots if you can. Also, I love that Montessori includes children in daily life. So those kind of activities are free and they're things you're doing anyway. So when you're preparing breakfast, a young child, you could have some cereal in a container where they can actually scoop out their own cereal into the bowl, and that becomes a Montessori activity. I said actually once when I was presenting a workshop, if you couldn't afford any materials, then I would just do food preparation all day with the children. You know, so they love to squeeze juice, they love to spread crackers, and there's so much involved in these food preparation activities. You've got the sequencing of all of the steps, you have the actual fine motor skills of holding a knife, spreading, you have the ability to prepare food and take responsibility and be part of and contribute to the family, which I think is really a beautiful part of some of the practical life skills, these skills of daily life. And there's language around it as well, like, look at this banana, the skin's very yellow, oh, it feels soft, and then the language can get more complicated as the children get older, using rich, beautiful language. Then also remember that there's libraries, there's sometimes toy libraries, and even I've seen toy rental companies, so you might be able to then pay a small amount, but you won't, it won't be as expensive as buying everything new. And the nice thing about a toy rental company is it goes back and you don't get a cupboard full of things that your child's grown out of. So that's definitely an option. I also know that some people are quite resourceful and swap with friends who are like-minded. So if you do know anyone who is interested in the Montessori approach, or, you know, they like wooden toys and those kind of things, it's really nice to have a few different puzzles for a few weeks and then swap back again. So that can be a really great way of building community as well. Then there are some Montessori friends of mine who love going bargain hunting. They go to the secondhand stores and the thrift stores, and I've picked up lovely baskets for no money, really, really, really cheap, so they can hold your activities and keep them separate, because that really helps the children see exactly what's available and they feel less overwhelmed. We can definitely talk about setting up our home. Actually, next episode, it will be great for giving you some ideas about how to set up your home. And you can look also for example, opening and closing purses and things like that. You can find secondhand wallets and hide little objects inside. That can be great. I've bought secondhand vases for flower arranging from the secondhand stores. And don't forget that IKEA can be quite a reasonable option. They're getting more sustainable these days as well, which is great. And they have like a simple TV unit that's about $15, a very simple one. And then you could display some activities on that. And if that's not in your price range, then even just on the floor in your living room, having, you know, them laid out along a windowsill or along the edge of the room, they'll learn where things go. So it doesn't have to be all of the Montessori shelfies that you see on Instagram and places like that. It can be very simple and still really beautiful. You know, look, I always find beautiful pictures in old magazines and then find a secondhand frame and put them in, and it looks like artwork. So you can be quite creative as well, rather than having to spend a lot of money on artwork for their age or for their height, but they're still just really beautiful. And I think that one of the things you could definitely do, which is also Montessori on a budget, is to set things up for them to be as successful as possible independently. So they love to be able to, you know, reach their own coat. So I had my niece and nephew visiting, and I realized that I don't have young children in the house all that often. So I just used some command hooks, which are hooks that have that removable sticky back, and I hung them down low, and they could put their hang their coats up down low. And that was very useful, because they didn't need to a parent to hang them up, and they didn't need to dump them on the floor either. There was somewhere for them to put their things. I love to put the bowls and their glasses down in a low cupboard or a low drawer in the kitchen so that they can help themselves and set the table and make their own snacks and things like that. So you can start to see and think, okay, how can I set things up so they can do this as independently as possible? So I think that if I really had to just buy a couple of things, I would recommend a stepladder or a way that they could get to help in the kitchen, because they really love to be involved in food preparation. And failing that, you can also sit at the kitchen table and prepare food together. And a low table and chair is lovely, but not necessary, but perhaps a secondhand one. IKEA also make a very cheap set, and you can cut the legs down to a good height. Someone would happily do that for you as well. So I think those would be the main things that I would suggest to start with. And I hope that helps you get started. Just be creative. So thank you everyone so much for joining for the first episode of the Montessori Notebook podcast. And I hope that you'll be back next week. We're going to have a lovely conversation with Trina. You may know her from Instagram as DIY Corporate Mum. And it's great to be speaking with her and sharing how she brings Montessori into their home, even though she's a full-time working mum, how she gets other people in her family on board with the ideas, how she communicates the Montessori approach to the carers who look after her children when she's at work. And there's lots about creativity and art and craft with children as they get older as well. So you're going to want to tune in for sure. Hit subscribe to make sure you don't miss any episodes. And I'll see you next week. Bye. Thanks for joining me for the Montessori Notebook podcast. The podcast was edited by Luke Davis from Filmprov Media and podcast art by Hiyoko Imai. To find out more about me and my online courses, visit themontessorinotebook.com, follow me on Instagram at @themontessorinotebook, or pick up a copy of my book, The Montessori Toddler, from your local bookstore, Amazon, or where books are sold. It's also available as an ebook, audiobook, and has been translated into over 20 languages. I'll be back in a week with more Montessori inspiration, and in the meantime, perhaps you'll join me in spreading some more peace and positivity around the world.